And now I want to tell you why, first of all, why every one of these length scales is associated with an important, very, very important order one, order zero mystery. And secondly, and this is really the point I want to emphasize, all of these mysteries are directly tied to putting together in one way or another the two great revolutions of the 20th century, putting together quantum mechanics and relativity, even special relativity, but which is the source of two of the puzzles here. But that's one of the really remarkable things, which will become clearer as I start actually talking about them, is that these mysteries are a direct consequence of the two pillars of modern physics, and of following the two pillars of the modern physics to their logical conclusion. So, and because of that, the problems in their entirety, taking them all together, really require understanding at a deep level every aspect of fundamental physics. They require understanding general relativity, they require understanding quantum mechanics, requiring special relativity, quantum field theory, cosmology, and when we talk about understanding quantum mechanics, they mean understanding, really trying to understand what quantum mechanics is, trying to understand, trying to understand it, and trying to understand its applicability in situations that go well beyond the Stern-Gerlach experiment. Okay. So it really covers the entire span of important questions in fundamental physics. One of the things that I'm going to emphasize over and over again, though, is that the problems that we face are fundamentally physical problems. Okay? They're not a question of maybe use this formalism or use that formulation, or you turn equations and you convert one equation to another equation, you write it in a different way, that things are going to turn out better. Okay? That never works. Progress in physics never happens by turning equations, ever, ever, ever. You need to have ideas. The remarkable thing is that you have to figure out how to convert those ideas into new equations. The new equations are typically not rewritings of the old equations using three changes of variable and some, you know it when there's an idea and a spark involved. And you know it when there isn't. And it's very, very important to be guided by the physics, by invariant questions, and not by pre-judgments and preconceptions of what the answer should look like. Okay? And here, there are really, between people, there are actually disagreements about the way to proceed. The problems are big, and so there are different groups with different different strategies and different attitudes towards what the important questions are and the approaches are. And people will, because this is such a very important zeroth order thing, people will very, very dearly hold on to their fundamental philosophies, and it's important that you hold on to your. It's important that you take a philosophical stance and you follow it through to its conclusion. It's also important to be flexible and make 90-degree turns if you have to. And that's really, again, if there's one rule that you have to apply over and over again to do great work, it would be very easy, and we would just teach people that. The problem is that you have to do contradictory things all the time. Okay, and it's always a tightrope between being conservative and radical, between thinking very abstract thoughts and doing very concrete calculations, between being very close to the data and being very far from the data. There is no God-given rule. It's an art, and you have to learn it by doing it. But anyway, I'm saying that partially because I will intersperse throughout the rest of these lectures many of these philosophical remarks, many of them which I hold strongly, some of which I've made 90-degree changes on throughout my own career, which has only lasted 15 years so far. Okay, so I've changed my mind radically about some things, and it's possible that I'll change it again. But everything that I will say with complete certainty, this must be the way things are. Obviously, this has to be the way things are. And you have to learn to disentangle and understand what the real notion of belief is in theoretical physics. Okay? Belief is nothing other than a psychological tool to help you work. Okay? And I really mean this. So when you're working on something, it's important to brainwash yourself to believe that what you're doing is the most important thing around, that it must be done in this way, because things are so hard that without some internal push, you will never make progress. Okay? But when you're done, you should feel free to cast those beliefs aside and find a new convenient set of beliefs for your new set of things that you're working on. I believe in serial belief monogamy, okay? All right? And serial philosophy monogamy, because philosophies and beliefs and things like that are just tools, psychological tools to help us make progress. Always remember this. And so always remember, a lot of the hot debates people have are about this meta issue and not about the actual thing. Okay? But anyway, I'm saying that just because I will make lots of inflammatory comments in these lectures. This is obviously crazy. This is obviously the way to go. That's stupid. And just, you know, remember, this is something which is part of my own psychological baggage that I'm using to propel me forward. And you should always remember that you need to find such a thing for yourself. You need to exploit it. I'm telling you, it's really useful. It's really, really useful. But you should always remember that you can shed them at a moment's notice if some evidence comes along, if something convinces you, or if simply you're working on something else. Okay? So I didn't mean to take so long to talk about a meta issue, but just so you know, because it's part of the way I talk, I will say things that sound that might sound a little extreme, but just take it with that grain of salt. Okay, so let's start talking about some of these crises. Yes. Yes, you can.
Why did you wipe the human scale off the blackboard? I mean, I know you said it's in principle understood, but
yes.
Is it in principle understood? I mean, the role of human beings as observers in quantum mechanics?
Yeah, so this is one of the things I have a strong opinion about. I don't think there's any really fundamental mysteries with quantum mechanics that don't involve gravity and cosmology. So
let me be, but maybe we can have a discussion a little bit later. But there's many issues about the interpretation of quantum mechanics. There's many issues about, in my own view, thinking about a lot of these things is not the correct direction, which is not to say that I don't think there's very fundamental mysteries associated with quantum mechanics. I really think there are. But in my view, the way to attack them is not to think about the formalism of quantum theory and interpreting quantum theory, but to go to the place where the physical questions become murky and you don't know the answers to them and you don't know how to proceed. There's a guarantee that there is a question that has an answer that doesn't just have to do with our own meta confusion about how to talk about things. All of those mysteries in quantum mechanics come out when you cannot make a clean separation between an infinitely large observer that can make an experiment infinitely many times and the system that you're looking at. When you're dealing with quantum mechanics in a closed system, okay, we have one situation where we have to do that, which is cosmology. So all of the mysteries, in my view, all the fundamental mysteries about quantum mechanics have to do and are brought to bear in the issue of putting quantum mechanics together with gravity and cosmology. Okay? So I'm not a pig-headed, shut-up-and-calculate quantum mechanic. It's very important to understand exactly what we're doing, to understand why there aren't real operational mysteries associated with the measurement process, decoherence, things like that. These are all very important things you should learn. If you don't know them already, you should definitely learn them. But as part of my worldview, I do not think any progress will be made by sitting around and meta-wondering about quantum mechanics at the level of Hilbert spaces and spin systems and things like that. There are many people in this building over here who believe that progress will be made like that, and I do not share that belief. Okay? I believe that quantum mechanics and understanding it, its deep origins, its meaning, and so on, will only come about by confronting it with the actual physical places where we have problems applying it. We don't even, in principle, know how to apply it to get out answers. We don't even know what the correct answers, questions to ask are. And that everything has to do with quantum mechanics in the closed system, cosmology, and gravity. Okay? So that's why I erased it. Okay? And there's many other things like that. I mean, by the way, I think a much better question along those lines, where I really don't know, and I think it's a really totally fascinating, is the question of consciousness. And this is one of the questions which, you know, we're not normally allowed to, it's not one of the things that you normally talk about a lot. You're a little self-conscious talking about it. That's funny. Self-conscious means talking about consciousness. Okay? But it's a real mystery. It is a real mystery. Okay? My own view is that you always make progress by finding the hardest possible question that you can start working on. Okay? So it's easy to come up with very hard questions that you have no idea how to get started with, and it does nobody any good to gaze at your navel and pat yourself on the back for talking about such a hard question without making any progress on it. Our goal is not just to ask questions. Okay? Our goal is to answer them and get them right. Okay, that's what's propelled the subject for 2,000 years. That's what we have to do. So consciousness is an absolutely fascinating question. I don't think anyone has any idea how to get started on it. I think it's not crazy that it might have something to do with quantum mechanics. So most people think it's crazy. Roger Penrose doesn't think it's crazy, and I don't think he's crazy. But I think we don't even know how to get started on that problem. If I were to leave the human scale around, that's the question that I would focus on. But it seems so hard to me, so far from even being able to articulate what the right question is, that it's not on my list of fundamental problems. Every one of the things that I'm talking about, you can get a toehold on. That's huge. Okay, that's because as you'll see, the problems are very easy to state, but 99.9999% of the art of theoretical physics is to figure out how to go from these vague things to actual computations that let the world guide you to the correct answer rather than you having to guess it. Okay? And you can do that by doing calculations and by making things concrete and by following things step by step. And believe it or not, this incremental progress works. Maybe the most revolutionary thing that we've ever discovered isn't relativity, it's quantum mechanics by a factor of 10. Okay, the strangest, most bizarre thing. How was quantum mechanics discovered? It was not discovered by people sitting around and wondering about determinism and whether it made sense and so on. It was discovered by people first looking at data and then doing tons of calculations, concrete calculations, step by step, incremental progress, toe holds that let them move to the next stage of understanding, the next stage of understanding. It took 20 people 25 years to invent it. And it happened like that. Okay, so all the time, in my own worldview, finding a concrete set of calculations associated in some way with the big question that you're thinking about, I will always prefer to do that rather than sit around upstairs and wonder what it all means. Okay? This is not because I'm a philosophical Philistine who doesn't believe in the value of any of these things. Quite the contrary. Okay? It's because I respect it enough to know that for it to be useful, it has to actually propel you forward and not just, anyway. But anyway, that's a global comment about a lot of the things that I erased. Okay, so let's start up here with the most famous problem, or the one that gets the most press for very good reasons, that has to do with the problem of putting quantum mechanics and gravity together. Okay, so now I write this as associated with the Planck length, but in fact. As we'll see, it's actually much, much more interesting than this. But let's first talk about it in this. Let's first talk about it in the usual way people talk about it. Okay. We just saw that as you get to distances approaching the Planck length, gravity becomes as strong as all the other forces. And in fact, if you naively continue, you remember we said the dimensionless strength was g Newton times energy squared. So if we naively continue to energies above the Planck energy or the distances shorter than the Planck length, the dimensionless strength of the interaction is big. Whenever the dimensionless length of anything is big, you're in trouble because you don't know exactly what it's doing. Okay? The strength of the interaction is just gigantic, and there's nothing you can expand in. There's nothing you can. There's no small parameter that you can help that can help you understand the physics. So, all right. So that's one problem. But in fact, the problem is more severe and more conceptually important than that. And that has to do with the fact that the very notion of space-time has to break down at 10 to the minus 33 centimeters. Okay? So at 10 to the minus 33, many things happen. Quantum mechanics and gravity become important. Space-time is doomed. So let's do the little thought experiment that shows you that space-time is doomed. Okay? In fact, really everything to do with As we'll see, the problems on these two ends have to do with the logical continuation of what happened to us in going from classical mechanics to quantum mechanics. As we went from classical to quantum, the number of things that we could in principle sharply predict in physics went down drastically, right? So Laplace thought we could predict the entire future if you gave the positions and velocities of all the particles, and then all of a sudden the world wasn't deterministic. You know, there's many, many fewer things that you could talk about. Some of the major conceptual challenges of this century have to do with the fact that there are even fewer things that we can talk about sharply and precisely when you take gravity into account as well. Okay? So In the next 15 minutes, I'm going to lay waste to almost everything else that we're used to predicting sharply so that we see what the actual problems are. Let's begin with space-time. Okay? So the poor classical guy thought that they could measure positions in momentum. Okay? And the big advance of quantum mechanics is to replace the word and with the word or. So we could do positions or momentum. But you can, in principle, measure a position as arbitrarily accurately as you want. Okay? If you want to do a position measurement, you just need higher and higher and higher energies. Arbitrarily high energies, you can probe arbitrarily short distances. Okay, that's why you beg for billions of dollars from governments to build accelerators, just because of the uncertainty principle. Okay? I mean, without the uncertainty principle, we could build a little fantastic Voyage spaceship to probe small distances. But we can't do that because of the uncertainty principle. You make the spaceship small enough, it starts breaking apart because of quantum mechanics. Okay, however, this doesn't keep going forever. And that's because of gravity. So let's just do a thought experiment. I want to measure this region of space-time, whose length is delta x. Okay? I want to see what's going on in there. Well, by the uncertainty principle, I need to have an energy in that region, which is around 1 over delta x. No h bars or c's or anything now, right? We're professional units people, right? So if the energy is 1 over delta x, right? OK, that's perfectly fine and dandy. But something starts happening. As I crank down delta x, the energy starts getting bigger and bigger. So there starts being a lot of energy density in that region, right? I'm putting more and more energy into a smaller and smaller region. Now, what happens if you put a huge amount of energy into a really tiny region? You eventually make a black hole. Okay? So let's forget about this for a second and just ask when you make a black hole. When do you make a black hole? Let's say you have a mass m and the radius is r, right? So you make a black hole when the escape velocity is 1, right? So that's when g Newton m over r is 1. Right? Everyone happy with that? Notice it has units 1, right? All right, very good. So when does this happen? As I crank up, as I crank down delta x, so let's write down g Newton. So there's g Newton. What is the mass? Well, the mass in that region is 1 over delta x. And the size of the region is delta x. OK? So when this becomes of order 1, then the region that I'm starting to look at collapses into a black hole. So that happens when delta x squared is comparable to g Newton, which, as we said, is 10 to the minus 33 centimeters squared, or Al Planck squared. OK? Yes?
Over r has to be
1. OK, great. So let's
figure out the Newtonian escape velocity. If you have a mass m, right? If you have a mass m and the radius is r, then if this is a Newtonian problem, then you'd need the kinetic energy for the particle to escape to infinity. You'd need the kinetic energy to balance the potential energy, right? So that's a half mv squared would have to balance gmm over r. Right? That's what determines the escape velocity. Because if it makes it out to infinity, then the energy just barely makes it out to infinity. The energy is zero at infinity. So just conserving energy makes kinetic energy. Right? OK, so v squared, the m's cancel, and v squared is 2gm over r. This is one of these happy formulas where the Newtonian and the general relativity answer are exactly the same, okay? Just by accident. The 2 is there in both cases. But I put a squiggle to save my ass, so I didn't have to remember the 2. Okay? All right? Everyone happy with that? Yes?
I don't understand why you need an energy. Like, I guess the first question is, what do you mean by measure this piece of space time? The other question is, why do we need energy in there?
Well, if you're going to measure anything, no matter what you mean by the notion of measurements, one way you can do a measurement is by scattering particles
into each other and seeing what comes out. Okay? And that's some probe of what's going on in there. Right? But if you're going to make any kind of measurement at all, then the wavelengths of whatever you're doing to make the measurement should be comparable to the size that you're trying to look at. Okay. So that's all. Exactly. If you want to do scattering experiments that resolve distance of order delta x, then the energies that you have to scatter the particles with have to be of order 1 over delta x. That's literally why we have to build these giant accelerators, right? If you think about it, I mean, this is a really cool thing because something that often lay audiences ask me when I give public talks is, why do you have these gigantic accelerators? Why do you have these huge accelerators with these huge detectors when it's probing the tiniest distances we've ever probed, right? And the answer is, it's the uncertainty principle. It's literally the uncertainty principle because the energies have to be so big. And the particles come out with incredibly high energies because they're being sent in with incredibly high energy, and you have to stop them in these detectors. So detectors have to be just gigantic just to stop these particles that are coming out. But indeed, to probe those distances, you need very high energies. Yeah?
We'll ask another dumb question.
Yeah.
Based on that, we can presumably define an arbitrary small length scale. So does that imply an arbitrarily high energy density everywhere?
Without gravity, yes. With gravity, no. And this is exactly the problem that we're coming to. If there's no gravity, then you could, in principle, make a measurement that probes arbitrarily tiny regions of space. Okay? And time and everything.
Does it have to be the making of the measurement, or does it exist whether you make a measurement or not?
Yeah, sure. But what we're doing is following a time-honored tradition in the history of physics of asking whether concepts make sense. Asking whether concepts can in principle be observed.
Okay.
So that's all we're doing, right? So we're doing the same thing Heisenberg did, and in fact, this is literally what Heisenberg did. Say, yes, you can. Unfortunately, you can't do position and momentum, but you can do position. You can do position, you just go to arbitrarily high energies or momenta. Now we're going to use relative distance, so I'm clearly using the word energy and momentum at the same time. But in principle, arbitrarily tiny distance is no problem. It's going to be enough energy. We just go to arbitrarily tiny distance. Right. Okay? But I'm now telling you that there's something operationally wrong with that. That there's no way of operationally measuring distances or time smaller than the quantum. And the reason is what we just concluded, right? The reason is that when you get the distances of order of the Planck length, you put so much energy into such a tiny region of space that the region that you're trying to look at, get information from, has collapsed into a black hole. Okay. Now, let's say you say, damn, that sucked. Let's try even harder. Let's scatter even higher energy particles. What's going to happen?
You make a bigger black hole.
You make a bigger black hole. Okay. So that means you're really screwed. Right? You thought going to higher and higher energies was going to shorter and shorter distances, and that's true. It's true until you hit the Planck length. And past the Planck length, it's the other way around. Past the Planck length, higher energies means larger distances. Now that's kind of extraordinary, because it means that there is no experiment we can even in principle do that would make measurements of 10 to the minus 45 centimeters. There's no such experiment. Now, you could always take the attitude, if there is such a thing as distance at tiny distances, but we can't measure it, okay? Now, that's fine, it's a meta thing, and, every philosophical attitude should be questioned. So this attitude that everything should be observable sometimes has led to good ideas, sometimes has led to bad ideas, okay? So it may be true that one should hold on to things that can't, in principle, be measured, even though they make it, but they make doing the rest of physics useful. And in much of our description of fundamental physics today, we have exactly concepts like that, all over the place. Okay? So it is not a rule of everything handed down by a strict dictator that everything should be observable. No, nobody said that. However, this style of argument has worked in the past. And it makes you strongly suspect, together with many, many other things like it, that the notion of space-time really breaks down with the quantum. And so therefore, space-time has got to not be a fundamental thing, it has to emerge from something more primitive. Yes?
What about when people try to calculate an upper bound for the radius of the electron, the size of the electron, and say that it's 10 to the minus 50 meters or something like that? How does that?
When people do that, they are, if anybody gives you a distance smaller than the Planck length, they are, just do not believe them. So, none of them, and nobody says 10 to the minus 50 meters for anything. But even what they mean by, you see, yeah. What they mean, this is another aspect of what I like to call the word problem in physics, right? It's really much more getting the actual correct answer for some physical observable process is more important than attaching the correct words to it, okay? Because a lot of the dictionary, anyway, the words are imprecise. The actual observable and the equations it describes are precise. And so often when people say there's a limit on the size of the electron, really they're doing some other measurement. They're measuring the dipole moment of the electron. They're measuring something like that, and then attaching words to it, saying this is the size of the electron. But really, they're measuring directly something else. We have no evidence that the electron is anything other than point-like on the scales, any scales that we've measured so far. So it's unlike the proton, for example, which we know is composite. And right. Yes.
I don't want to make the conversation sidetracked by being too philosophical, but you're saying that when you try and measure space-time lengths at this Planck length,
yes,
you can't do it. But then you make the conclusion that since we can't do it, it can't exist in and of itself.
Yeah.
So is it fair to say space-time doesn't exist at these lengths just because we can't see it?
No. In fact, so I really think, and so this is why I was
stressing this point about language. It doesn't even matter the words we say, okay? What does matter is that there are standard words that go with space-time break down here, right? What you replace it with is research. So we don't know what we have to replace it with. Could it be you keep talking about space-time, but you attach other words to it, atoms of space-time or something else, but the word space-time continues to be there? Maybe. Could it be that you have to just trash the entire thing and there's some completely different underlying starting point, and space-time is some approximate long-distance illusion that comes out of that? Maybe. Okay. But it's very important to always delineate regimes, right? Regimes where a standard nomenclature is useful and regimes where it's no longer useful. Thinking about space-time in the usual way ceases to be useful at the Planck length. Okay? So whatever extra inference you want to make about what that means is up to you, but it has to do with how we actually solve the actual physics issues. Yeah.
I think that it is useful probably to have a different theory of space-time at those Planck scales. But nevertheless, even if it remained the exact same as we think of it,
it cannot remain exactly the same way as we think.
Well, we can't measure it and make sure it's the exact same way, but it could still be that way. If it's a smooth, continuous space-time, and the only reason we're saying it's not that is because when we pack that much energy into that area, we're creating black holes, and so we can't see it.
So again, every single set of, it's funny because we tend to always put these mysterious sounding issues about the words at the boundary of our current knowledge. But if you think about it, issues like that occur everywhere else, even things we understand perfectly. Right? We use the word electrons move around all the time. Have you seen an electron move around ever? Have you?
No.
Right. So why do we say that? Why do we use these words, electrons move, because that picture of electrons moving allows us to get the right answer. Okay. Yeah. It's a nice mental picture, and it's a nice set of words that help us guide the actual calculation. The actual laws, the laws of quantum electrodynamics, involve a local interaction of electrons moving in space-time with light. But what they give you the right answer for is a picture of me seeing you because the light bounces off you and comes to me, right? The whole picture of electrons moving around is an intermediate in getting the right answer in that picture, right? So this goes back throughout everything we've done since just a little bit after Newton. The second things started getting a little more abstract compared to what we could literally see and touch. Everything is an extrapolation. The question is only if it's useful or not. And this, I really want to stress, this is not some kind of, it's not a kind of philosophical philistinism. It's really the other way around. It's trying to make sure that we're stripping away any inessential crap part of it is just that we as human beings aren't tailored perfectly to answer questions like this. So the more you get to use the actual physical situation and set up an actual experiment with an actual definite, in principle, answer, right? Then what I'm saying is that it used to be that energy is way beneath the Planck length, but if I scatter particles with each other, believing that they're propagating on a smooth manifold and interacting locally with other things helps me get the right answer. Right? That will cease to be true when you scatter the energy above the quantum. So in that sense, the picture of the local space-time, the things moving around in it, just does not give you the right answer. Okay? So whether or not it's still there or not is a total meta issue, which I think has nothing to do with the actual physics. And so that's why it's very powerful to focus on actual questions with a definite answer and outcomes. So an actual question with a definite answer and outcome is you collide particles together, you collide two protons together, and you watch what comes up. What is it that comes up when you collide them at energies, you know, that we're about to go to with the LHC? What happens? You collide two protons together, what comes out? It's a bunch of high energy particles. Okay? That's the quarks hit each other, things come out, and so on. Right? Maybe we make new particles, maybe we make, but it's some
the same basic picture. We go to higher energies, even higher energy particles come out. If you scatter particles at energies 1,000 times the Planck length, something very weird happens instead. Okay? You make a big black hole, and that big black hole decays by Hawking radiation. So we get very low energy particles coming out. Okay, it's a totally striking, shocking difference between the regime beneath the Planck scale and above the Planck scale. And that's the invariant question. Okay? And precisely how the particles come out is something that we still don't know exactly the answer to. Precisely because we don't know the answer, because we don't know the... So these little thought experiments aren't precise. They're just telling you something is up. Okay, and the art is to go from that something is up to try to figure out what to do about it.
I'm wondering whether to ask another dumb question.
Yes, this is the point.
So you could always break something down into arbitrarily small lengths at the edge of the table. So we could break down something into arbitrarily small lengths with arbitrarily high energies. So why is the table and the universe not composed entirely of black holes?
Oh no, because this is one of the hold on to that question for a second. And this is another one of the other two crises that we're talking about. So really hold on to that question. It's actually a better question than you realize, I think. But literally what you said is not. Hold on. If that question is answered by the end of the lecture, I will come back to it. Okay. So
somehow space-time has got to emerge out of. Something else. Now, there's something even more surprising about this. This is usually not emphasized, but let me tell you something else, which has to be sacrificed. Well, this is kind of obvious because we're saying that space-time doesn't really exist. Okay, so space-time, at least the usual notions of space-time, don't exist. Something else that goes out the door with that is any notion of any kind of local observable. Okay, so locality and local observables are gone. Okay. But again, what do I mean by that? Very sharply. Okay. Let's ask a question. Let's say I want to do some experiment. Okay. Let's say I want to do an experiment like I don't know. I want to weigh this. Here's a local observable. I want to weigh this. Okay? So I put it on a scale. I'm weighing it here. I'm putting it on a scale here. Right? So here it is. Okay? There it is. All right. I'm doing it in this room. Right? Doing it somewhere. I'm doing it at least in a region that's as big as that and the weighing apparatus. Okay? Now, but I want to imagine that I want to get the mass of this guy to arbitrary accuracy, right? So if I'm an experimentalist, what do? I mean, I can do it with some accuracy, like stick it on a crappy scale, and then I get an answer that its weight is whatever, so many kilograms plus or minus something, right? Just, so I'm plotting its weight, and I have some confidence that I'm getting the right answer, and there's some width to that confidence, right? Now, actually, I gave an example that's very classical sounding. Really, the world is quantum mechanical, so really I should do the experiment also, really, to remove the probability. I want to do the experiment infinitely often with an arbitrarily large apparatus. Okay? So I want to have an arbitrarily large apparatus so I can make infinitely accurate measurements, and I have to do the experiment infinitely often. There are two infinities that go into making a sharp prediction. Okay? And that's because of quantum mechanics. Life sucks, we don't get to determine everything, but we can get sharp answers out. So we pat undergraduates on the head and we tell them, don't worry so much. We can predict probabilities exactly. That's okay, things are still okay, right? But what that means is that there's two infinities that we're talking about. We do the experiment infinitely many often to reduce the statistical uncertainty just from quantum mechanics to zero. And we have to do it with an infinitely large apparatus. Okay? And the apparatus has to be infinitely large for many reasons. First, to make an infinitely accurate measurement. Secondly, to have infinitely perfect decoherence between the system and the apparatus. Okay? Otherwise, you could have some, with a tiny probability, a huge quantum fluctuation in the entire apparatus and get the wrong answer. Okay? So you want to make the apparatus infinitely big. There are two important infinities in getting sharp answers out because of quantum mechanics. Now, gravity removes at least one of those infinities and makes it impossible. Often it removes both of them, and that's when we have the biggest mysteries of all. Okay? But let me tell you about the first set, which is the easiest to talk about. It removes the infinity of being able to make the apparatus arbitrarily big. Okay? The reason is simple. You see, no matter what I'm making this apparatus out of, if I wanted to have more and more ticks, let's say, so I can measure the mass to more and more accuracy, it must contain more and more bits. Okay? And if the whole thing is living in a finite size box, then every bit has a minimum amount of energy associated with it, just the uncertainty principle energy of order 1 over the size of the system. Right? So that means that I cannot increase the number of bits arbitrarily without cranking more and more energy into the system, even if it's big. Right? Even if it's big. So what happens is I try to make the apparatus bigger and bigger, but keep it in a finite size, is at some point the apparatus has so much mass that it collapses everything into a black hole. Again. Okay? So there's a fundamental limit to how accurate you can make any local measurement. So in other words, when these formal people come around and tell you quantum gravity says there's no local observables, there's no locality, and the grubby experimentalist in the basement says, what the heck am I doing with my life? You know, I'm doing these local measurements all the time. Screw you, right? What am I doing? Right? Then the answer is yes, but what you're measuring is not perfectly sharply defined. There's no experiment you can even in principle do that would reduce the systematic errors to zero. Okay? That's a startling fact. That everything, every single thing that we're doing is not perfectly sharply defined. It's not even the limit of something which is perfectly sharply defined. There's no experiment, of course you say, oh, my experiment sucks, it's not perfect, and so on, but there's some, you know, perfect experiment I imagine that I could have that would yield a perfectly sharp answer to the question that you're asking. Without gravity, yes. With gravity, no. There's a fundamental limitation to every single observable. Now, what is that limitation? Okay. I'll tell you the answer. The answer is that the accuracy of any measurement, so you know, this is literally the measurement as a function of the number of trials. Okay, so you do it perfect infinitely often, you make an arbitrarily sharp experiment. But anyway, the relative error for any measurement that takes place inside a region of space-time bounded by x and y, roughly, okay, is e to the negative, the area of that region in units of g Newton. Okay? Those of you who know a little bit about black holes will recognize this as e to the negative, the entropy of the black hole that would eat up the region of space-time that you're looking at. Okay? After a couple of lectures, you will be able to do this estimate yourself. I won't do it right now. Okay? But I just want you to see that this in principle limitation is truly minuscule. All right? No one in their right mind would care about this practically. Okay? But it says any local measurement you make at all cannot be made perfectly accurate. And there's always that minimum amount of systematic error associated with it. Okay? So you see, here is another very sharp way of showing there's no such thing as usual space-time, right? That means that there's no perfectly well-defined, because of quantum mechanics, We knew that we had to do the experiments many times. We had to make the apparatus much bigger than the system and so on. Okay? But now you add gravity and there's just a limitation. You're screwed. Okay? There's no sharp answers can come out of any local question because of this argument. Okay? This already tells you something really extraordinary. If someone says, I have a theory of quantum gravity, you say, great, what does it calculate? That's always the first question to ask. What are its observables? What is it going to spit out? If they say the observables is something to do with the measurement you do here and there, you already knew they're doing something wrong. There is no such thing. There's no such thing. There's no actual experiment that they could be giving you a sharp answer for. Okay? This is a very, very important point. It's just like as if someone came along somewhere between classical mechanics and quantum mechanics while things were being developed. Someone came along and said, hey, I have a theory of quantum mechanics. We say, what does it predict? It predicts positions and velocities. They're a little bit fuzzy, but it predicts positions and velocities. That's just wrong. You don't say the word and. It's the word or. And that was the big leap, right? So similarly, anybody who says, I have a theory of quantum gravity, you ask, what are its observables? Okay? What's the actual output of any, what does it compute? And if the answer is anything to do with the word local observables, you should be very suspicious. But there's no experiment that can measure those things. Okay? So what does it compute? That's a very good question. Okay? That's a very, very good question. Yes? So
what do you exactly mean by error on that side?
What I mean is that what this is really telling you is that there's a limitation on the size of the Hilbert space of the apparatus that will
measure the system. Okay? That, in fact, there's a limitation on the size of the Hilbert space of the system plus the apparatus. Okay? But the dimensionality of the whole Hilbert space of the system plus apparatus is bounded by e to the entropy of the black hole that would eat up the room in which the experiment is being done. Well, no. It's saying, that's something that that's something some people say, but I would say the whole thing isn't really sharply meaningful. Okay, but this is saying that if you try to, what we're doing is seeing whether our standard concepts make sense and then pushing them until they break down. Right? This is saying we're trying to do what we were taught, which is to make a sharp prediction out of quantum mechanics, and we fail. Okay, and we fail precisely when the size of the error starts approaching that amount. I mean, when an experimentalist does an experiment, they come back and they give you some systematic error, right? Yeah. Some error they can't reduce because of the physical setup of the apparatus, right?
So it's supposed to be something like an English standard deviation.
Think of it as akin to a standard deviation. The reason I'm not saying exactly standard deviation is that there's two kinds of error. There's statistical errors and systematic errors, right? Statistical errors is what you can in principle reduce by doing the experiment in Pouliot. The fundamental source of statistical errors is quantum mechanics. Really, the fundamental source of all errors in physics is quantum mechanics. We have the fundamental source is quantum mechanics, since things aren't deterministic. Okay? But there's two kinds. There's statistical error, which you just reduce by doing the experiment n times. You reduce it, and it goes like 1/√n. Okay? So literally, you collide things, you do it once, you don't know what comes out. Too bad. You do it a billion times, and you start getting a curve. Right? And if you ask for a particular question, the number of times the particle comes out in this particular direction, you make the histogram of every single time it happens. The histogram gets more and more sharply peaked around one answer, and it approaches that answer like 1/√n. The width goes up 1/√n. So that kind of error you can reduce just by doing the experiment infinitely often. There's another kind of error, which is just that, my apparatus has so many registers, so I can't resolve whether it's there or there. Okay? That second is the systematic error. Okay? This is telling you that the systematic error cannot be reduced infinitely. The systematic error cannot be reduced infinitely without collapsing everything into a black hole. And so you can't get the answer out to the question that you want. So this already is a very, very, very important fact. I'm bringing this up just so you see that even though this is a minuscule effect, it is not something that's purely down at short distances. Okay? The problem of quantum gravity, unlike the way people thought about it 20 or 30 years ago, is not merely a problem that's confined to the quantum level. Okay? It's really something that exists at all length scales. And there are, in fact, macroscopic situations where this effect can become important. Okay? For there to be macroscopic situations where that effect is important, clearly there has to be some e to the plus s somewhere to make up for this tiny e to the minus s effect. Okay? But there are situations where there are those e to the plus s's. The infamous problem of black hole formation and evaporation, the famous black hole formation paradox, is exactly such a problem, where there is a compensatory e to the plus s, which makes up for this e to the minus s fuzziness and gets you to a big paradox of applying local physics. There's other problems that have to do with the inflationary universe, where the volume of the universe, in the theorist's mind, the volume of the universe starts exceeding e to the s, because it's explosively inflated. And that is also a place where, even though it's horrendously macroscopic, it's very likely the effects of quantum gravity are becoming important. So it's not something which is merely, control down to very, very short distances. This gives you a very clear idea, I think, of how big a conceptual leap is needed. But let me answer the question, what does it compute? What does it compute? Well, the answer is kind of startling. Let's talk about some idealized cases. Some idealized cases are where we have a space-time which is asymptotically flat. By which I really mean imagine something that just looks like Minkowski space, but with a few small disturbances. So I can throw in some particles from infinity, and they can bang into each other, and they can go back out to infinity. Okay? In order to be able to make any precise measurements by the logic that I told you, what I have to do is not make the measurement local. I need infinitely large apparatuses, and I need to do the experiment infinitely many times. And I can do that if I send particles in from infinity, they bang into each other, and they go back out to infinity. I can measure them coming in from infinity, because they're widely separated from each other. They become infinitely separated from each other, and I can measure all their properties with an infinitely large apparatus. Okay? And also what comes out, I can measure in the same way. Okay? So if you have a space which allows particles to come in and go out, then there is something that you can compute precisely. There is at least a precise observable that could be an output of a theory of quantum gravity. That's the so-called scattering matrix, or the S matrix. Okay? So scattering amplitudes are a sharply defined thing that can in principle be measured and computed. Sorry, they can in principle be measured, and therefore they should be an output of a theory of gravity. Of course, we have a way of computing scattering amplitudes in ordinary theories. Okay. That's what you'll learn about in your quantum field theory course here. And the way we do it is we say, no, really there's a nice local theory, electrons and photons, they scatter into each other, you know, they come along, we draw these Feynman diagrams. The Feynman diagrams represent pictures for how things happen in space-time. Okay? But the actual scattering amplitude in the end is something that doesn't make any reference to the underlying space-time. Right? The actual scattering amplitude, you send some things in from infinity, tuck, they go out to infinity, tuck, with some amplitude, and you just measure those things in infinity. The intermediate space-time is one incredibly convenient way we found of mapping the minus infinity to the plus infinity. What these arguments are telling us is that the textbook way of talking about these things cannot be correct. Okay? There must be a second way, another way, of getting the same answers without putting in the intermediate space-time. The intermediate space-time is in our head. The actual physical observable does not have it. Okay? And however, you know, clearly in some approximation physics is local. And so we've naturally stumbled on the way of describing nature that uses it in a fundamental way. But we must banish it. You know, the next step is going to force us to banish that idea. Another thing, this is also why, by the way, I mean, the arguments I'm telling you is also why something along the lines of atoms of space-time just cannot make sense. Maybe in some formalism you can talk about atoms of space-time or things are discrete at short distance, but that's all in the formalism. There's no answer. There's no question to which those things can be the answer to. If you're dealing with a space that's flat, minus infinity and plus infinity, then maybe you can compute the S matrix. Okay? But it's not like you know, the theory of quantum gravity will not allow you to compute the mass of this piece of chalk, right? That's just a local question, does not have a sharp answer. Very, very important to keep the distinction between formalism and physics in mind. Okay? So, and it's always a good idea to focus on the things that can in principle be sharply predicted. Now, what I told you was one observable when the space is flat. A huge amount of progress was made 10 years ago, starting with Juan Maldacena's work,
in another situation where the space is negatively curved. Okay? So every time there's a boundary, the big lesson is that the only sharp observables in gravity that we can have because of quantum mechanics and gravity involve things that are infinitely far apart from each other, period. Okay? That basic observation already goes back to the work of Bryce DeWitt in the 1960s. Okay? So somehow, the well-defined physics lives at the boundary of the space-time and not in the middle of the space-time. That observation goes back a very, very long, long way. Things that sound a lot like it are called the holographic principle, Lenny will be here and he'll tell you more about the holographic principle, but really the sharply well-defined notion of the holographic principle is this thing that Bryce DeWitt already said in the 1960s. Okay. What Molisena and friends added to the story is to look at this in the less familiar case of a negatively curved space. When you have a negatively curved anti-de Sitter space, it also has a boundary. Okay? And there are also sharply defined observables associated with the boundary. That boundary is much more familiar. It's paradoxical because the bulk space-time is not as familiar. But the boundary is much more familiar. The reason is that the time that runs in the center of the space is the same time that runs in the boundary of the space. Okay? And therefore, the evolution in the boundary is just normal causal evolution that we're used to. It's a normal quantum mechanical system. Okay? And that's this famous ADS-CFT correspondence tells you that everything that's going on in the middle of the space-time is encoded in terms of an ordinary quantum mechanical theory that lives on the boundary. That's possible because the times are the same in the boundary and in the bulk. This flat space case, where the bulk is more familiar, it's Minkowski space, the boundary is very funny. You ask, what is the boundary of Minkowski space? You say, you go infinitely far that way. That's not the boundary. That's some space-like infinity. Okay? The boundary is null. What makes it out to the boundary are light rays. Okay? So the boundary of Minkowski space is a much less familiar space. It's a space which has lots of null directions in it. And so it's not so easy to think about what the system is that might live there, that might directly tell you what these observables are. That's why this ADS-CFT case was so great, because, as I said, even though the bulk was less familiar, the boundary was more familiar. And so one could make progress on this question. Okay? This ADS-CFT example also shows you how extraordinary the answer can look. You see, it looked as far away from atoms of space-time as you could imagine. It says there is no space-time at all. There is instead some four-dimensional quantum field theory normal system that lives. It's four-dimensional. It's got normal particles, normal things in it. But all of its strong interactions make it completely equivalent to a five-dimensional, 10-dimensional string theory with gravity and all sorts of other wonderful things in it. Okay? So it is not at all like you go to short distances and then you see that there's little discrete things. It's not that picture at all. Totally different. Okay? And that's a good example of why you should not let preconceptions guide what you think the nature of the answer is going to look like. Okay? Here, instead, by focusing on the actual observable, which are the things you can measure at infinity, that was a better place to start. Okay, so space-time is doomed, not just at short distances, but somehow this can even happen at long distances. Okay. I'll give you a good analogy because I think it shows the size of conceptual leap that has to be made to keep going. The case of negatively curved space is in a sense completely understood, but it's not even close to being our world. Okay, there's a couple of steps that we have to go to make it to connect it further to the real world. But let me just say this. This entire issue is very much like what happened in going from classical to quantum. I try to make this analogy because I think it's a very good one. As I showed you, it's already about one more layer of things that we can't predict and that we have to learn how to deal with. But even more specifically, imagine what the classical physicists would have thought about the atom. Okay. In thinking about the atom, in fact, what the classical people, where they thought classical mechanics was breaking down was the fact that the electron was point-like. And they had lots of obsessions with the point-like character of the electron. They worried about it, the singularity, it had lots of problems, and so on. Nobody thought that classical mechanics in itself was breaking down in applying it to the problem of the electron moving around the proton. In fact, they're right. Classical mechanics itself is not breaking down there. The classical calculation is perfectly well defined. It gives the wrong answer, okay? Atoms can't look like that. But there's nothing within classical mechanics itself that's declaring, I'm breaking down, I'm in trouble. right? There is some place where it's declaring I'm breaking down, I'm in trouble. That's the point-like nature of the electron. Okay? But nothing in the problem of the electron going around the proton indicated that. Okay? However, there was one cure to both ills, and that was quantum mechanics. Okay? Quantum mechanics solved the problem of the point-like character of the electron. In fact, quantum mechanics and relativity solved the problem of the point-like character of the electron. Because as you went to shorter and shorter distances, when you hit the distance of the Compton wavelength of the, so let me just actually remind you of this. This is actually an important point. What did the classical people think? They thought there was some radius of the electron. How do they determine the radius of the electron? They said that if we look at the energy that's stored in the electric field around the electron, right? So what is the energy that's stored in the electric field around the electron? In our fancy units, we know it's got to have an alpha, so it's alpha over r electron, right? That's the energy, right? So they said, well, the size of the electron should be such that this energy isn't much larger than the mc squared of the electron, right? Otherwise, you'd have a funny situation where the energy in the electric field is way bigger than the energy that the electron has. So that puts, that tells you that r, the size of the electron, shouldn't get too much smaller than this, right? So that's r electron is alpha over m electron. So the classical people made this prediction that something should happen. Physics should change, the electron should have a size, something should happen by this distance. Okay? And they set out to build models for it. Abraham and Lorentz and people built models of the electron as a shell, blah, 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 and all these things were just wrong. They're wrong because the right answer is quantum mechanics. The right answer is actually quantum mechanics and relativity that says that this picture becomes modified and that instead the electron is actually surrounded by a cloud of electrons and positrons. Okay? A big cloud of electrons and positrons so that you don't know which the central electron is. It gets smeared out. Okay? Now, how big is the cloud? How big is the typical size of the of these electrons and positrons flitting in and out of existence? What could it be? It's just one over m electron, right? That's the Compton wavelength. Okay. So that's the typical Compton wavelength. It's one over m electron. Okay? There's no alphas in here because this is just a property of the vacuum. Things are popping in and out, right? So in fact, so you see that there's something very nice because the classical people weren't wrong. The classical people said something had better happen by here. Otherwise, we're in trouble. The right answer did not end up being that it had a size or anything like that. It had a much more radical answer. Okay? But the radical answer kicked in earlier than it had to. Okay? This one over m electron is much larger than alpha over m electron because alpha is small. Okay? So way before you got into classical trouble, you saw that the whole picture had changed. Okay? So quantum mechanics did solve the problem of the point-like electron. So where classical physics was waving a white flag and saying, rescue me, quantum mechanics did rescue it. But it also made an appearance in places where classical mechanics was not waving a flag. Okay? The problem of the electron going around the proton, classical mechanics is perfectly happy to answer that problem. And yet it gets the answer completely wrong. Okay? Gets it totally wrong because of quantum mechanics. So now that's it would have been one thing if somehow the theory is breaking down somewhere, and the next theory just comes and takes over and gives it a hand. That's what happened with relativity. Okay? That's why relativity is not as big a conceptual deal as quantum mechanics. This fact did not happen in relativity. Really, things broke down exactly where they were supposed to break down. The velocities got comparable to light. Okay? When classical physics waved the white flag is when relativity rescued it. But not so in going from classical to quantum. Similarly, right now, the first way of talking about the problem of quantum gravity, that we have to probe that as we get the very tiny distances, gravity becomes strong, space-time breaks down, et cetera, et cetera, that is the analog of the problem of the point-like electron. It is a problem. It definitely needs a solution. Okay? But there are situations where the effects of quantum mechanics and gravity make an order one perturbation on top of naive long-distance thinking, just like it did for the problem of the electron going around the proton. And that, as I said, happens when these e to the minus s effects get hit by compensatory e to the plus s that can occur in a variety of situations. We might talk about some of them later, but I told you two of them. The black hole information paradox, as well as the problem of cosmology, and in particular inflation, really force these issues on you. Okay? So that's why it really seems like a similar kind of conceptual leap is needed. Now, if you ask someone in 1890, you know, in 30 years, and you told them 30 years, physics is going to be different, really different. X's and P's aren't going to make sense, you know, just what would they do? They would say, let me put phase space on a lattice. Maybe that's it, right? I'll put phase space on a lattice. There's no X's and P's perfectly. Okay, and that even gets part of the way right, right? You know, for simple problems, that's more or less what the old correspondence principles were about, or the old Bohr-Sommerfeld quantization rules were more or less put phase space on a lattice. You should only take certain minimum volumes in phase space and so on, okay? But it was really an intermediate crutch. In the end, it was not atoms of phase space. In the end, it was no X or P. You couldn't ask for a bigger change, order one change from the old principles to replace the word and by the word or. Okay? And so that's what makes it seem much more reasonable that, space-time is just going to be period replaced by something else. And its connection to its connection to the something else will, I think, be no closer than the connection between the whole Hilbert space apparatus of quantum mechanics with psi of x and the old picture of classical phase space. Okay? So that gives you an idea of the scope of the challenge. But it's, again, very important to figure out where there's a precise answer. Is there a question that we can have a precise answer to? In flat space, in asymptotically negative curvature ADS space, the answer is yes, and it's done. In flat space, the answer is we don't know. Okay? We don't have this replacement of space-time, even in flat space. And now let me come to the final, most confusing thing of all, which actually harkens back to, so let me go back to my picture of the scales. So here we are obsessing about what's going on at the Planck length. And as I've told you, it's probably not just at the Planck length. If we go all the way out to the Hubble scale, we have another problem. And all of the problems have to do with cosmology. You see, our world is locally pretty close to flat space, but it's not globally pretty close to flat space. We had a big bang in the past. And, well, let's talk about the future in a second, okay? But already in the past, we're not free to set up any old initial conditions we want and to do the experiment infinitely many times, right? So even the scattering matrix is not actually an observable in our own universe, right? We have some, you know, so half of it is gone, right? So, gosh, we're being left with fewer and fewer things that we could possibly predict sharply. What could we be possibly left with? There's one thing you could have been possibly left with, which would have made a lot of sense pre-1998. Okay? And when people talk about things like the wave function of the universe, this is really implicitly what they're talking about, is the following, again, and whenever someone says a fancy-sounding word like wave function of the universe, the dumb question you should ask always is, what the heck are you computing? Please give me an experiment whose answer this is the answer to. Okay? And actually, there is a good answer for the old notion of wave function of the universe. This is what it's computing. Okay? For something that you can do, even if you're not free to set up initial conditions, is you can at least count. Okay? You can do a census. You can look out at the world and just see how many red stars are there, how many blue stars are there. It doesn't seem like much, but you can do that. And as the universe gets bigger and bigger and bigger, you see more and more and more stars, more and more of them come into your cosmological horizon. So in principle, you start getting an infinity. Remember, we have to build up infinity in order to be able to compute anything, to measure anything with perfect accuracy. You start getting infinitely many red stars, infinitely many blue stars. You figure out what is the ratio of stars that are red or the ratio of stars that are blue. Those are in principle outputs that are in principle perfectly sharp outputs of some theory. Okay? So you basically wait for the universe to become infinitely big, and just the relative populations of everything you see is something that you can predict. At least you can in principle measure, if that's what your future was. Okay? If the future was that you could see infinitely many things, then you could in principle do that. So when people talk about the wave function of the universe, like this guy there and his and his famous collaborators. Okay, this is implicitly what they're talking about. They're giving the answer to a question like this. You know, if the universe becomes infinitely big and we have infinitely many copies of infinitely many things, what are the relative fractions of each one of them? I don't get to set up the initial conditions, so minimum thing I can do is give you these relative fractions. Okay. However, everything changed in 1998 or earlier, but when people started getting convinced that the universe is accelerating. Okay, this is a famous fact that you've all heard, the universe is accelerating. That means that there are parts of the universe that we will never see again. Okay, they are accelerating away from us, and they're gone. They're gone, they're accelerating away from us superluminally, they're gone. More or less everything we see in our universe today is everything we're ever going to see. Okay, because the universe is accelerating, things aren't going to keep coming back into our cosmological horizon. This is the final nail from quantum mechanics and gravity to what we can predict, because now it leaves us with nothing. Okay? Leaves us with nothing. Because we have a finite number of things out there in the universe. That's all we're ever going to get. That's what we're stuck with. That's it. So this is a really major problem. This is a really major conceptual problem. Of course, none of this matters practically. You know, there's 10 to the 88 particles out there. That's plenty for many purposes. Many experimentalists would be happy with a 10 to the minus 88 error on things. Okay, but it means that there is no question in our physical universe that we can see, apparently, because of quantum mechanics and gravity, there is no question that has a perfectly sharply defined answer. So what the heck is supposed to be the output of a physical theory? I don't have an answer. This is a research problem. Okay? What is the output of a physical theory supposed to be when you have quantum mechanics in a closed system? Okay? In a closed, finite system. So when I said before that I do think there are important issues with understanding quantum mechanics, they're there, and they're brought to light here. You don't have to go searching for them in the middle of Stern-Gerlach experiments or you know, they're really sitting us and hitting us in the face in trying to describe the universe that we actually see. But they have to do with gravity and cosmology. Okay, it's this final triumvirate of quantum mechanics, which reduced our what we could predict a lot, gravity, which reduces it some more, but in and of itself leaves us with some things to predict. Okay, if we could imagine general space times, in negatively curved space time, there's a lot to predict. In flat space times, there's a lot to predict. In a cosmology where the universe becomes infinitely large in the future, there's a little to predict. Okay, in our physical cosmology, there appears to be nothing to predict. So this is a very deep conceptual puzzle. What does it mean? Maybe one thing it means is that we have to give up on this notion of perfect mathematical precision and figure out how to talk about things that aren't perfectly sharply defined mathematically. Okay? That will be the first time in the history of physics that that has happened. But that certainly seems to be one chain that one would have to follow. Or maybe there are much more subtle observables that we haven't thought about. I think that's actually much more likely. That these arguments about what observable you can compute are somewhat crude, and that there are things that involve much more entangled questions that might have perfectly sharply defined answers. Okay? Or maybe there's something else. Maybe something has to give. Maybe quantum mechanics is wrong. Maybe, but you know, if anything like that is going on, this is the place where it's likely to show up, in my view. All right, so that's one set of questions that have to do with quantum mechanics and gravity, which, as I said, people began discussing at the Planck length, but which very likely casts a shadow over everything. Okay, and understanding properly casts a shadow over everything. Now I want to tell you about the other two questions, but how am I doing for time?
10 minutes past.
Past 12?
Yes.
Okay. Then maybe I will start with the other two questions tomorrow then, because I think, huh? Oh, that there's. But are you guys dead? Can they eat in here? Oh, it's actually outside. Okay, you know, never mind. Let's just pick it up again tomorrow. We'll just pick it up again tomorrow. Okay, well, why don't we keep going right after lunch? Yeah, why don't we just finish right after lunch? Great. Yeah. Yes.